Can you hear me? Great. Good morning. Wow, that's an echo. Do you hear the echo as well? Yeah, there's an echo. Now it's better. Great. Okay, well, good morning. How are you? Happy? Anyone sad? Good. That's good. Okay, so welcome to the second and final day of Tech Days. I was in Belgium 3 days ago. That was Tech Days. This is Dev Days. So today's talk is about ASP.NET MVC, and it's a little bit of a real-world architecture. It's a 300 level, so I'm guessing that everybody here knows and has worked with MVC for about 3-4 years. Is that right? That's a joke. How many of you have actually worked with MVC? Okay, that's good. How many of you work with web forms? Okay, stop. So, my name is, I keep forgetting to say my name. My name is Hadi, and I work for a company called JetBrains, which if you haven't heard of, you've probably heard of another company called ReSharper, which is actually the product, not the company. JetBrains, who are JetBrains? We met ReSharper, right. So I work for JetBrains, and I also have been working with MVC since preview one. Before that, back in, anyone is more than 20 years old here. If you remember a product called Delphi, anyone heard of Delphi? Don't laugh, it's not that bad. Delphi. I used to work with ISAPI web broker, and before that I used to work with CGI, which all followed the kind of the MVC pattern. Okay, so web forms. How many of you have worked in the past with web forms? How many of you are happy to not be working with web forms? Good. So web forms was great, right? I'm being very sarcastic here. It was bringing RAD to the web, right? It allowed the desktop developers, the VB developers, to go over from doing desktop development to web development with the same kind of way, the flow that you would create desktop applications, you would create web applications, right? You could do the drag and drop and all that. Of course, nobody told them that where you had a desktop, you had one machine, and when you had a web, you had one machine with a million clients hitting it. That was a minor detail people left out. But it gave them the kind of same experience of, here, I can now create web applications. And it gave us really, really powerful controls, right? Because a grid is a grid that every business application in the world needs a grid, right? The first thing we put on our business application is a grid. And the second feature we add is an editable grid, because every customer wants to edit 10,000 rows at the same time. And every customer wants to view 15,000 rows at the same time. So they gave us these powerful grids where you could sort elements, you could change elements around, and they gave us this version of the grid, they gave us this version of the grid, the view state. And I'm sure there is not one single person, there's always one guy in the room that loves view state. Is he here? No, he's not. And if any of you have worked with view state, you know the pain that you had to suffer, right? The best practices were, if you want to have a scalable application, switch off view state. Which was like, really? Anyway, I showed this to my colleague today, and he had nausea. He's like, oh God, this takes me back so badly with bad memories. So we had view state. We had this one that you needed to actually go to university and study, right? The page life cycle of what happened when and at what point. The people that came up with, okay, never mind. So, but the thing is that they told us that visual designing is productive. Drag and drop is productive. Problem is that that's quite a fallacy, right? The more controls you drag and drop on your form, the less maintainable it becomes in the long run, right? It was initially great. I could spin up an application, drag and drop things over, and it just becomes brilliant application. But of course, over the years, those little event handlers start to grow in size. We start to get the business logic in the event handlers. And then we have to solve that problem. So they introduce a hack, which are called partial classes, right? And they say, oh, you have business logic. Well, yes, I am writing a business application. Oh, we didn't think of that. Yes, we'll put that in a partial class. Okay? And as our application grows over time, the productivity decreases because we now spend more time trying to maintain that application than we did if we had done it right. Now, web forms did have ways to do this right. There was patterns called MVP. Anyone heard of MVP? Model View Presenter. That was kind of the hack solution, the better way to do web forms, because it allowed you to kind of separate things out. But that's all gone and behind us, it's over, and now we have the savior, which is MVC. Okay? And this one is going to stay because it's not a Microsoft technology, it's a patent, and it's been around for many years. Okay? They just made a version of it. Right? So MVC is good because it allows to do model view controller, which is the concept of separation of concerns, which allows you to do modeling on one side. Your views do one thing and your controller does another thing. Right? The model is your database object, your domain, your data set, your XML files. Your view is the user input where the user gets information and you spit out information. And your controller is this guy that talks to the two of these, interacts with them. So there's a clear separation of concern. But just like web forms, and as Scott pointed out wisely yesterday, it doesn't matter. You can still write crap code with MVC as well, right? Just like you did with web forms. I'm not saying everyone did, but web forms kind of said, file new crap code. Here it's like, file new, you can do well, but you can also write crap code. So I normally kind of want to give you a list of patterns and anti-patterns of, over the years, what I've tried, what has worked, what has not worked for me in terms of scalable applications. And scalable, I don't mean in terms of performance only, but in terms of scalability over time, so I can maintain it over time. Okay? So this session is going to be a little bit about those things. Now, there's hundreds of tips and tricks. There's hundreds of things that you can do and you cannot do. I've tried to sum up a few of them and put them in a one-hour session. Okay? Since we're kind of a small room, if at any time you have any questions, please feel free to keep it to yourself. I'm kidding. You can ask me. Another thing is if I hear you. So one of the things that I like to do is start with the tight coupling, because this applies to absolutely everything we do in life, right? This is an anti-pattern, okay? Tight coupling is an anti-pattern. That means that our code is tightly coupled. One of the reasons that ASP.NET web forms failed to be a testable system is that it was very tightly coupled. When someone comes to you and says, can you make an automated unit test of this? You say, no, unit testing is too hard. Unit testing is not hard. What causes it to be hard is the underlying code, right? If I have everything tightly coupled together, it's very hard for me to try and test things in isolation. If I can't automate that testing, what happens? I don't test it every time I make a change. What happens? When I make a change, I break code. And if I don't have any tests, then whole hell breaks loose, right? That's kind of like buying your kid Lego, right? And he makes this tower and you say, oh, use super glue. Okay, just so that it doesn't break again. It'll be great, but the thing is that the whole point of Lego is what? To be able to rebuild things, right? It's tear down what you made, lose 7 pieces. If you've got kids, you know that then you hoover and the other 15 pieces get into the hoover and you got to dig your hand in there. Story of my life every day. And so sometimes you're like, well, super glue actually might work well. But it's about being able to decompose things and put them back together again, right? So I'm going to show you this. I'm going to show you a quick code. And I'll focus on one aspect here. I'll focus on testability. How many of you do unit testing? Okay. If I come back here next year and you come to my talk again, let's try and make that 100%, okay? So I will talk about unit testing here, but this is not about unit testing. It's about many other things, and hopefully we'll have time to show you other benefits of doing loosely coupled code. But since testability is something that you more or less all, because everybody knows what unit testing is, yeah? Put up your hands. Who knows what unit testing is? Yeah. Who thinks it's good? Yeah, there you go. Who does it? Yeah. Okay. So one of the things that they gave us in ASP.NET MVC is this whole aspect of testability. I can test my code. I can test my controllers, right? I have my model from one side. I have my view from the other side. And I have my controller from the last side. And I can test it, right? So here is a controller, I have a customer controller that talks to a customer service, gets the customers, and returns it. If I run this, it should display a list of customers, okay? And all that works great. Yep, it works. So now let's go and see my home controller test. I have home controller. I create a new instance of home controller. I get back index, and I check to see if the index is null or whatever. That's probably the most silliest test they could have put in there. It would have been better to not even write that test, right? But it comes in the default template. So I have that. Let me go now to customer controller tests. First of all, the name. Forget it. That's a really bad name for a test. However, take a look at that. Is that a unit test? No. Why not? Because customer controller, when I call index here, what's that doing? Calling customer services. What is customer services doing? It's calling customer DAO. Yeah, that's an integration test, right? And the problem with that is that now we have tight coupling. So as I start to add more code to my application, as I start to add more data into the database, it starts to go slower. When I don't have a connection to the database, my tests fail. Do they fail for the right reason? No, they fail for the wrong reason. And this is all coming from one thing, that we are tightly coupling code, right? Customer controller over here is creating an instance of customer services, and it should not. It should not do that. It shouldn't be tightly bound. So one way to solve this problem is the concept of inversion of control. How many of you have heard that? Good. So inversion of control means, let's take, to put simply, customer services right here, what does it do? It's in control of the objects that it creates, right? It says customer services, I need a customer DAO, so I'll create a customer DAO, right? So it's in control. Inversion of control, think about what we're doing is we're inverting the control from the class that consumes those things to the caller. Caller is now responsible for passing those things that are required into the class, right? How can I do that easily? How can I create a method that I can change the input parameter easily? Now the answer is in the question. Input parameter, right? So that's exactly the same concept. This whole baloney around, oh, inversion of control is hard and dependency injection is hard. It's not hard. It's nothing. All it is saying, take your dependencies, take them out of your class, and pass them in as parameters. That's it. However, I'm not going to pass it in as a parameter to my index method, am I? Over here. I'm not going to pass it in as a parameter there. I have a dependency to customer services. I'm not going to pass it there. Why? Because the chances of more than one method using the same dependency are high. I also don't want people to create an instance of my class without having that dependency. Why? Because it will blow up. What's the best way to do that? Constructor, right? So I can take this guy, remove this guy, and now my code won't compile. Why? Because customer services requires a dependency. So here in my test, sorry, in my code, what I would do is I would create a new customer DAO. Done. Although I wouldn't do that. But that would be one way, right? I would now create a customer DAO, and therefore, now it's not tightly coupled. It's passing in the dependency. How about in my tests? Would my tests run? Sorry, where am I? In here. I'm passing it in there. But what's happening now? Now I've got a tightly coupled controller. I'm in the same boat. Right? I'm in the same boat. I can't do that. Why? Because now, fine, I took it out of customer services, but now I've got it in here. So what you actually do is you pass this in as well. So you create a constructor, and you pass in a customer services. That's it, right? And then this guy is actually going to be a field. And which we'll initialize in the construct. Okay? Get rid of this guy now. So what I'm doing there is now passing in my dependency through the constructor of the controller. Okay? So now I have decoupled the class from the actual service. And I'm passing it in through the controller. Now my test won't compile. Right? My test won't compile. It doesn't matter. But let's run this and everything should work. And if I write here customer, like before, it should all work. But it doesn't. Why doesn't it work? Because MVC takes the URL, it decrypts it, finds a controller, creates an instance of it. When it comes to create an instance of my controller, it can't. Why? Because there's no parameterless constructor. It doesn't know how to do that. Okay? How do we fix that? That's very easy. This is the exact same code with the problem solved. And I've got to create a bunch of classes, which are called dependency resolution. And there's this object. How many of you have heard of the iDependency resolver in MVC3? The iDependency resolver is kind of like a service locator which allows you to plug in your own mechanism to resolve your dependencies. How are dependencies solved in .NET? They're resolved using a framework called an IOC container. Unity is an IOC container. Structure map is an IOC container. Meph, despite what they say, is an IOC container. There are a whole bunch of IOC containers. Job is already done. All you got to do is plug it in. How do you plug that in into MVC? Via the dependency resolver. But it doesn't matter. You don't need to do any of this. All this code you see here, you don't need to do. None of that. Because now, how many of you have heard of NuGet? You must have heard of NuGet by now, right? This code over here is generated for you automatically. All you have to do is install a specific package, right? So if I go back to my previous solution, the tightly coupled one without dependency resolution, watch what happens. I'll go to the package manager console, and it'll blow up on me. And I'll just hit enter a couple of times, and it's good. Okay, so now you see that I have nothing here, no dependency resolver folder or anything. And I want to install an IOC container. Now, the guy I use a lot is structure map. I like it. So I say structure map. Okay. And you can install structure map. But structure map won't give you anything. All it will give you is an IOC container. You still have to write all that pluggable code by hand. However, there's another version of a package on NuGet, which is called structure map-mvc3. And you have this for structure map, you have it for ninject, you have it for a whole bunch of things. So I could say install package structure map MVC3, and if my internet connection works, that will download the package which has a dependency on structure map, and it will create a bunch of files for me, which are all those ones that I just showed you in the previous example. Okay? So you see it's adding structure map, all the dependencies it has. It has this thing of a web creator, which we'll see a little bit later on. And now, if you go to the solution, you see that I have my dependency folder. Done. And now it will work out of the box. All you have to do is now configure your IOC container, which, if you're using something like structure map, you don't even have to do if you follow conventions. Conventions is the key here. Structure map by default says, when you ask for iCustomer services, I will give you a customer services. How will I know? Because I'll just take your interface, remove the I, and look for a class with the same name. You follow that convention, you're done. You don't even have to register your dependencies. So now there is absolutely no excuse ever in your life to not use an IOC container. All that nonsense about, oh, this is not a real scalable, maintainable application, nonsense. Okay? Don't do poor man's dependency. That thing I showed you where I said bad code, where I create a default instance, that's called poor man's dependency injection. And it's horrible. You're not solving any issues there. Okay? Very easy. Nothing to it. The FAT controller. So this guy is another anti-pattern. When we start applications, we start to put everything in the controller. We put mapping code. We put lookup code. We put business logic. The only responsibility a controller has is to get data and to push it out. And what I normally do is I get some code as an anti-pattern. So I went to CodePlex, and I downloaded a controller that I found on some project. And it was too long to fit on a screen, so I made a video of scrolling it, right? And this is all scrolling, right? It actually took around 2.5 minutes to scroll through this controller. Okay, he doesn't even know the concept of version control. He leaves code in there, commented out, right? Who needs it? That is an anti-pattern. Your controllers should be very, very small. And no, if any of you know of the plugin RockScroll, do you know it? It's a little thing that sits on the side of your scroll bar, which gives you a preview of your file. That is the wrong hack. When people say to us, ReSharper isn't working properly with RockScroll, we're like, we don't care. You're trying to solve the wrong problem, right? If your class has those many lines, either fix it or become a singer. Seriously, a class should only do one thing. That's not doing one thing. Trust me. Okay? So, controllers should be thin. I always say, you know, it's the idea of separating the concerns again. I have the model, I have the view, I have the controller. Okay? That's all it is. Spaghetti code. When MVC first came out, they said, oh, this is spaghetti code. This is all over that, you know. Now I got stuff because, you know, they showed the view page and they showed code in there and they showed markup and they said spaghetti code is back again. Right? No. Again, we're going back to the same thing. If you write bad code, you get spaghetti code. Right? Here, think of each element separate. Okay? Model, view, controller. The parsley is what gives it the finishing touch. Yeah. Someone once asked me, what does the parsley represent? I said, you. So spaghetti code is not, does not ship out of the box with MVC. It ships out of the box with Web Matrix. That's a joke. But it's always the same thing. Well, it's half joke, right? No. Single responsibility principle, it boils down to the same thing. Separation of concerns is, at a global level, the same idea of a single responsibility. You're familiar with that, right? A class should only do one thing and one thing alone. It shouldn't do multiple things. Because if it does multiple things, what are the chances that me having to touch that class every time I want to change some code? High, right? What happens when I touch code? I break it. A class should only do one thing. It should only ever have one reason to change. And single responsibility is applied at all levels, in all fields, all the time. How many of you are married? Of the men? No. Of the men, how many men are married? Right. Girlfriends? Yeah. Have you ever tried to do something while talking to your partner? While she's talking to you? Doesn't work, does it? It's like, you're not listening to me, are you? I'm like, yeah, yeah, I am, really. No. Or you are on Twitter and Facebook and you don't have a life. I'm like, yes, I do. I've got 280 friends. So this is the principal idea, single responsibility. And I always say a good rule of thumb is write your controllers as if you wouldn't ever have to test them. Because if you don't have to test your controllers, it means that they don't have much code in them, which means that you're doing the right thing. And we'll see how to accomplish that a little bit. Now, having said that, I do BDD. Anyone does BDD here? Behavior-driven development? Test-driven development? Right. So I always say BDD is TDD done right. Okay. So I do BDD, and BDD is about writing functional specifications. When I go to the home page, it should display the menu. That I write as a controller test, because it gives me a functional, compilable specification of what my system does. But beyond that, I'm not writing test-to-test logic in the system. Okay? So thin controllers. How do we put our controllers on a diet? How do we make them thin? Well, First of all, we apply single responsibility. We apply separation of concern. We think about the controller on what it is exactly. What is it? It's just an object that takes data and gives back data. That's all it is. Okay? How do we do that? Well, one thing we could do is dry up our controllers. Okay? You know what dry means? You just did. You didn't. Someone else did. Yeah, dry is about do not repeating yourself. If you have boilerplate code, like for instance, I have a bunch of methods, which is if authenticated, do this in one method. Next method, next action. If user authenticated, do this. Next action. If user authenticated, do this. The other one. Try. Do something. Accept or catch. Lock some value. Logging. Security. All of these things are things that we constantly repeat over and over again. And we really shouldn't have to, right? Why? Well, each class we say that should only have one responsibility, right? Single responsibility principle. A class should only change for one reason. Now, if my class is dealing with customer services and at the same time is doing authentication and is logging, what happens? It's doing multiple things. But the thing is that that logging and that authentication is common to a whole bunch of different classes. To different behaviors in my application, they're all common. It's a cross, as they say, it's a cross-cutting concern among multiple classes, okay? So one way of solving that problem is via aspect-oriented programming. What AOP allows us to do is apply cross-cutting concerns across our code over multiple classes. There's many ways to do this in .NET. You can do it with libraries. There's a library called PostSharp, which what it does, it takes your code, you compile it, and before you actually have the ultimate application, it will inject some things in there. There are more simple ways of doing it with filters, attributes, right? Attributes in .NET is a kind of AOP. And attributes is one of the good things, one of the big things that we have actually in ASP.NET MVC. There's also the possibility of using interceptors. Now, here is another thing of what an IOC container is good for. When I showed you the registration in the previous code where I said an iCustomer service maps to a customer service, right? That's trivial. What an IOC container also allows you to do is intercept that call with something. So now I can write an iCustomer in terms of structure map for iCustomer service, use customer service, enrich with proxy authentication. And what that will do is, am I losing my voice? And no one says a word. Am I that loud?
Yeah.
Really? I'm sorry. So what interceptors allow you to do? I'll try and keep it down. So what interceptors, I just get so excited. You know, I'm sorry. So what interceptors allow you to do is enrich behavior. Right? That's another key benefit of an IOC container. You see, dependency injection is not only about testing. It's about multiple things. One of them is using AOP with interceptors. Global filters. That's another thing that's new in MVC 3. Before, in previous versions of MVC, you saw that we had some code. So the home controller has normally, in previous version, had a handle error. Right? You all saw that. Remember? Default templates, MVC2 always have that. They don't have that anymore. Why? Because normally we want all our controllers to handle error. So instead of applying it at an individual level, and sometimes we forget to do that, that's why trying to abide with dry is good, because you don't have to do repetitive things over and over again because we forget. We're humans. What we do is now use the concept of global filters, right? So this guy is new inside MVC3. And what it does is register a global attribute, in this case, handle error, and that will apply to every single controller, to every single action. That's why it's there. Now, the disadvantage of this is that it will apply it to every single controller and every single action. Sometimes we don't want to do that. Sometimes we want to make filters not attributes because we forget to put them, but based on some requirement. Let's say, for instance, I make a streaming site and I only want people that are connecting from the US to be able to view my videos. And I have no idea that I can purchase a VPN for $2 a month, right? So, not saying I do that, but. So, what can I do? I can create a new concept in MVC3, which is called a filter provider. And a filter provider is just a class which is injected into the process, and it allows us to get access to the controller context, right? So when a request comes in, inside that class, I can say, ooh, the request, what is the user agent? What is the IP? If it matches a certain condition, apply a filter. If not, don't. That's a very powerful feature that now is available in MVC3. So apart from global filters, which apply globally, as the name says, we also have filter providers, which go on an individual level. And throughout this session, I'll show you a bunch of examples that we can use with global filters and filters in general. Filters. This is what a filter does. When an action comes in, there's a whole bunch of filters that get executed, right? So every time I make a request, an on-action executing happens. What is that? That is an event that is raised when prior to the action being executed. Then another filter, another event, because filters can be implemented as attributes or as events. Another filter is executed. It's the on action executed. After that, another one comes in, which is the on result executing, which happens right before a result is rendered. And finally, the on result executed, which you can pretty much guess what it does. Okay? These are quite powerful because they allow us to do different things, and I'll show you some demos now. One of them is unknown record. The reason I'm doing this is merely an example, right? This doesn't work for all scenarios, but it does show you a good way of how to apply filters in a certain scenario, and the idea is how to dry up my controllers. Okay? Here's my customer controller, and you see that I have a simple action that checks gets an ID of a customer by contacting some customer service, and if it's not null, we'll display it. Okay? Now here is code that we keep having to write over and over again. We can do it this way, we can do it in the view, in multiple ways, but it ends up, the point of the example is, imagine that we're doing it this way, and we have to write this, if customer is null, then raise a resource not found. If it is not null, then just display it. Okay. So, here is another version which does exactly the same. The only difference is that I've now created my own custom resource or resource result, which some of them now exist in MVC3. This was MVC3. This was MVC2, which all it is an action result. So this is an example of how you can implement an action result, override an action result, and then set your own kind of message. In this case, I'm setting a 404. Okay, so that comes over nicely as a 404 exception, which is what resource not found is. However, this is another way of doing it. All I do now is tag on an attribute which says handle record not found. And you see the if statement's gone, right? There's no if statement. There's no if customer is not null, display it. If it is, then throw a resource not found. How do I do that? I implement an attribute. Which attribute can I implement? Action filter attribute. Which event do I override? On result executing. And I say, if the view, it's a view result and the view data has a model and the model is null, then throw a resource not found. Now, this isn't production code. This is example code. It's not going to work in all scenarios. If you have a view model or a model that you're displaying that in turn has also objects, and those objects are null, it might not work for you. However, when we get to models, we'll see what are good practices around displaying things in views. Okay? But the core idea to take away here is that we can use the power of the event on result executing to plug in, see models, see if they're null, and do whatever we want with them. The final example I'll show you is a different thing using the same event. Okay? Any questions? The model. Actually, let me just show you another example quickly. out of the box now in MVC3, we get two types of authentication. We get forms authentication and, well, it's actually forms authentication, but now we can do membership provider and we can do domain, Windows-based authentication, okay? But it's still using forms cookies under it. So what if I want to use HTTP authentication? HTTP authentication is the guy that when you go to a website, you get the dialog box that says prompt your username and password. That's very useful in RESTful architectures because that's kind of the base thing for doing authentication when you're doing REST architectures. How do I do that? Well, remember that there's an event which is on action executing, which happens before an action takes place, right? So what I can do is create an action filter attribute again and override that event. So the way that HTTP authentication works is that when the browser makes a request, the browser, if it's a protected site, will respond with a status code of 401 and saying www authenticate if and only if it does not find a header sent by the client, which is authorization. When that happens, when the authorization isn't sent, the response comes back to the client, to the browser. That's when your browser pops up that dialog box. You then fill in that information, send it over. The way that that information is encoded is not secure. That's why you normally use SSL with HTTP authentication. All it is a base64 encoding that when decoded, it's just username, colon, password. But for demo purposes, what I do here is just validate that the username is equal to the password. If it is, I then hook into code access security, set the identity. That's it. That's all I need to do. From this point on, the whole MVC framework takes over, .NET takes over. How do I use HTTP authentication in my actual controllers? Via the attribute I just created. So if I go to admin controller, you can see that I have HTTP auth. That's it. So instead of the authorize, which is the forms one, I use HTTP auth. And I can set that at the controller level. I can set it at the action level. And if you run this, see that you get the browser box come up. So I can go to about us. I can go to home. Nothing happens. I go to admin. I get the browser. I type in, hit enter, and I can get access. Okay? So that's another example of a different event that we can use to hook in. So the model. MVC3 is now opinionated, right? Up to MVC2, there was no such concept as a model. There was a model folders, but there wasn't a model where MVC was kind of influenced by, which is Ruby on Rails. And Ruby on Rails, by default, out of the box, they use a model, a data access model called Active Record. Right, where each object represents a record in a row. In MVC2, there wasn't. In MVC3, there wasn't. With the tools update, now there kind of is. Now it's binding that model to what you would call entity framework code first. Okay. However, let's talk about this model. I ran a poll on Twitter some time ago, and I said, do you use strongly typed views? And we'll see that in what all this means in a minute. The majority of people said yes. I then asked, if you use strongly typed views, what do you do? Do you bind directly to your domain model? Do you bind to a view model? Or do you just have a domain model as a reference of a view model? Those were the responses. So you see the majority of people bind directly to a view model. Then if you do bind to a view model, how do you handle partial updates, which is another problem, which I'll go through all these issues in a minute. And a lot of people deal with it in the controller, which leads us a little bit to fat controllers, right? And then if you bind in a domain model, how do you deal with extra data such as country list? Where do you put country list, right? Again, we'll see that in a minute. Let's look at the different options we have and how they can influence our architecture, and what benefits and disadvantages each one has. So let's start with the domain model. This is my customer. So imagine that I have a customer, whether I read this from a database, I read it from an XML file, whatever. This is my customer object. This would be equivalent kind of to what you would get with entity framework code first, right? The whole scaffolding that now is available in MVC. So I have an ID, a full name and email, and a list of invoices, right? And I say I'm going to bind directly to this domain model. So when someone makes a listing, it's going to get this guy. Can someone tell me an initial issue that might appear there if I want to make a list of customers with their name and their email? Yeah, exactly. I didn't hear a thing, but that's it. So means, why should I bring back a list of invoices? Right? That's what you were all saying, no? Why should I get back a list of invoices? But that problem doesn't exist, right? We've solved it, right? It's called lazy loading, right? So now I don't get a list of invoices, which is good. So of course, I put this in the view, and then here comes Joe. Who's Joe? A newbie developer. And he's like, oh, they want the invoice numbers. Oh, okay. Oh, cool. I have access to the invoices. I'll just do a for loop. What is that going to do? That's the select n plus one problem, right? It's, oh dear, now every time I iterate through an invoice, I'm going to make a round trip to the database server. And that is quite dangerous. So this is an issue when you have a direct binding to your domain model. That's one. Here's another one. Partial updates. I now want to update only the email. Yes, I can make a form that only has email, but my customers can save that form, add a new input box, put full name, and submit that. It will work. If I don't protect that on the server side, it will work. So how does MVC allow us to overcome that problem? With this little hack, which is add the attributes that you want to exclude from the update. So these won't ever be sent over to the server. That's another issue when we're binding directly to a domain model. Here's another one, extra data. How many of you store your customers like this in your database? So your customer has an ID, full name, email, list of invoices, the country he's from, and a list of all the countries in the world. You don't, right? So if you don't, where do you stick this guy when you want to display that? When I say to you, create a form for me where I want you to update the customer, and I want you to have a combo box where I can select the country he belongs to. Where do I stuff this in? View back. So now I have from one side the domain, from the other side the view back, right? That's one solution, using a view back. Okay? Here's another way of doing it, using a dynamic approach. This is what a couple of languages use in the world, PHP, Ruby, which have a couple of sites as well, like Facebook. They use dynamic languages. Dynamic languages, I don't have a concept of a tightly bound class. How many of you have worked with dynamic types in C#? Okay, they're very powerful. Now, in MVC3, by default, we get this, view back. All that is just a dynamic type. Okay, that's all it is. Instead of view data, instead of where we had before, so in MVC2, we had view data, message, equals whatever. In MVC3, now we have view back, message, equals whatever. Can someone tell me what's the difference between those two? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. First is a dictionary. So let's say, for sake of argument, the second one is implemented as a dictionary as well. Hold on a second. Let's say, for sake of argument, the second one is also implemented as a dictionary. What's the difference now? No, view bag is dynamic. It's not strongly typed. I can use the message keyword in the view, and I can use message one as well in view. And if message one doesn't exist, it'll just give you a blank screen or a runtime error, depending on what you're doing. And it's a dynamic type, so it's not really strongly typed, right? The difference there is that there's less noise. That's pretty much it. In the top one, I have the square brackets and the quotes. In the bottom one, I don't. It's less noise. So what is the difference? If I now say to you that view back and expand the object, again, for sake of argument, exactly the same way under the covers. What is the difference between these two? Well, the answer is on the board, right? The top one adds clarity. It adds intention. I have a customer, right? This one, I have a view bag, right? That's the difference. Both of them will fail if you type incorrectly name in the view. But it does add clarity using this guy over here. So can I use dynamic? Should I use dynamic? No, hell will freeze over. If you have a type, right? If you have a type which is exclusively for listing, nothing else, or if you want to pass in two values to a view, why not? What is the advantage of adding another class which is strongly typed to add name and email? If there is no advantage, why not use it? PHP uses it. I know we don't want to compare ourselves to PHP developers. It's like blasphemy. Any PHP developers out here? I should have asked. I'm sorry. I didn't mean anything bad by it. Any Perl? Okay, we can pick on Perl. Right. Any VB? No VB. VB. Oh, but yeah, VB. No, not VB. My condolences. I mean VB.net. You like to make fun of them. Okay. So yeah, nothing will happen. PHP uses it. Facebook uses it. Nothing will happen. The worst that could happen is that if you type customer name and in your view you type customer nam, it won't show. But you will see that it won't show because we do run our applications at least once. Just once. Seriously, this is not a joke. I was working once with a guy. He was from the Canary Islands. Anyone from the Canary Islands? No, I'm from Spain, so you can pick on me. He was from the Canary Islands. Makes some changes to an invoice, ships it to the customer. Customer calls me. He's like, I press on the new button, it blows up. I'm like, really? Yeah. So I go back to this guy. I'm like, did you test this? He's like, yeah. I said, so why is it blowing up? I don't know. So we spent 2 hours trying to see what's the difference between the customer side and their side, right? And I'm not with him. He's like, what happened? So he says, I don't know what the problem is. So anyway, I download the code. I check it. I compile. I run it. Hit new. It blows up. I'm like, I won't say his name. Let's call him Jose. I say... Or better, if anyone has seen Fawlty Towers, we'll call him Manuel. Don't mind him, he's from Canary Islands. So I say, Manuel, did you even run this? He's like, no. I'm like, what do you mean? I thought you said you tested it. He said, well, it compiled. See, in the Canary Islands, it's not a joke, he said to me, in the Canary Islands, I wasn't actually testing. All I did was make sure my code compiles. Then someone else would test it. The best thing that happened to me is that he said he was under too much stress and he went back to the Canary Islands. So, yes, you do run your code. And if you run your code and you see that it doesn't appear, that's the worst scenario. Okay? And if you don't have unit tests, you are running your code, right? How many of you have QA departments that are not subcontracted or outsourced to your actual customer? Okay, never mind. So, the last option, the view model. Now, this is what I do a lot. This is pretty much what I do. Your view defines your model. That is, now I let my views dictate what my actual model is going to look like. And we call that a view model. If any of you have done MVVM, how many of you have done MVVM? Right, in WPF, which is another way of calling the MVP, but because we have all that XAML, we'll give it a fancy name and we'll call it MVVM. So, but it's under the covers pretty much similar to MVP with the XAML hacks. So, the view model is what my view looks like. What is my user interface for input and what is my user interface for output? Based on what that looks like is how I'm going to define my actual model that I'm passing in via the controller. Right? So here, my intentions are clear. If I want to create a screen to update the password, I create a customer update password view model. Okay? Now, the immediate reaction to this is going to be, oh, Class overload here. It's fine. NTFS can accept a large quantity of files. Right? Whoa! Navigation issues. Come to our booth. We'll solve that problem for you too. Okay? But the point here is that it does add clarity. It adds specific intentions. So when a guy that's working with me, right, because we don't write code for us to understand. We write code for our partners to understand, right? A guy that's working with you comes and says, oh, you know where you update the password? I want you to now add this other feature. It's very easy. All he does is add a field. Now, what he does with that information, we'll see, and how we can ease that pain a little bit, okay? Because what is the main disadvantage of this feature? The mapping. So now I have a customer who I need to update the password. So now I've got to take the customer edit view model, get the password, pass it over to my customer. So now I have to, you know, retrieve my customer, copy all the values, save, right? However, how many of you have heard of the concept of domain-driven design? Right, one of the things that domain-driven design says, don't randomly, you know, update objects, express intentions. Drive your code the way the domain is. Your code expresses your domain. So instead of customer.edit, customer.password equals new password, customer.save, what you do is customer.changePassword, pass in the password. Right? Why? Because it adds intention. Okay? Because you can know exactly what the operation that the user wanted is done. Change password. Whereas if I just randomly update values, what happens? I lose intentions. But we fix that. We add logging. Right? And we'll say, oh, what did he do? Every time he updates, add some logging. So we'll put logging and we'll put a little hook and a screen comes up. What did you just do? I changed the password. Oh, okay. You're a computer. You should know. Right? And that's based because we're just randomly updating values. Point being that a lot of times, this doesn't translate into mapping 50 properties. Yes, if I'm updating the address, it's going to be 5 properties. But many times, it's just calling methods with 1-2 parameters. Okay? That's one thing to take into account. Second thing is, though, yes, but it does. There are times when I have address, city, postcode, street, whatever, and I have to map that over. How can I solve that? Do I do the mapping manually or not? So that's another question I asked in the poll. I said, if you do use a view model, how do you do it? And I was quite surprised that 49% of the people use this concept called the automapper. How many of you have heard of it? How many of you like it? It's good. It's great. I'll show it to you. 36% still have not heard of it. And 4% are not happy. And there's a... I didn't specify if... Oh, yeah, they're not happy with this issue. Here are other solutions. Automapper must manual, etc., etc. Okay, so here is Automapper. Basically, what Automapper is it's an open source library that uses convention to map things. Okay, that's all it does. So it says, if you have a class that has 5 properties that are called A, B, C, and D, and you want to map it to another class of any other type, that has 5 properties called A, B, C, and D, or has 3 properties called A, B, and C, what I will do is I will map A, B, C to A, B, C. D and E, doesn't care. It's not there, I won't map it. Right? And it has some default conventions which for 90% of the time work. If you don't like the default conventions, you create your own. But we're developers. What are we best at? Those edge cases, right? We go to the so much extreme to build in edge cases into our systems just in case one day I have an edge case that won't match my conventions. Do you know why Ruby on Rails is so successful? Because the guy has a strong opinion and he says, you don't need edge cases. Most of the time it works. And trust me, it does. Use conventions. Embrace conventions. That's the one takeaway from this talk is embrace conventions. Because you only can do a lot of these things if you embrace conventions. Okay? So, Automapper. All you need to do to install it is just do install package. I love NuGet. How many of you love NuGet? Don't let Scott know that. Install package automapper. Done. Right? And I'll show you a little addition I've done of how to create Lego module kind of things and how to make that even better. Okay? So that's how you install it. I won't go and write the code. I will show you some code that I wrote this morning at 5 in the morning. Yeah, I radically changed this talk from what it was last night at 9. So if you like it, let me know, because I was up late. Of course, you have nothing to compare to, so you can't say, oh no, I like the other talk better. So what I do here is, first in the MVC application in the root, now you wouldn't do this here, I'm just putting it here for, you know, just to, for shortcuts, you start to create these maps. You say, create a map that knows how to map a customer. Can you guys at the back see that? Zoom it. I rebooted. Did everyone get the Windows update this morning? Yeah, I had to reboot. Mapper.createMapCustomer-CustomerDetailsViewModel. That means create a map so that you know how to map from a customer to a customer details view model. So I do that once in the application startup, okay, and only once. Then in my customer controller, in this case, for instance, I have customer get customer by ID, customer details view model, and then I call the mapper. Map customer to type of customer details view model. That's it. Return customer data's view model. That's all I have to do. And that will take my customer, and it will map it to the customer details view model with the properties it has, and I push that over to the server. Nice and clean, right? And the code is pretty clean. You don't have to do much. Use it. It's really good. Seriously. That's what I'll show you later. But there you go. That's a good suggestion. See? Let me just quickly write that. Done. Any other questions? The question was, shouldn't you use a filter? Yes, and I'll show you how to later on, okay? And I've got a NuGet package for it. So, an improved validation. Fluent validation. How many of you use fluent validation? One guy, and he's a PHP programmer. You rest of you should be ashamed of yourselves. So, fluent validation. I'm going to show you a project that I'm working on. It's a secret project. No, I'm not. I'm just joking. Basically, validation out of the box with MVC is pretty cool now, with MVC 3, except you have to use the attributes, right? You have to decorate properties with attributes, but it's got some cool things like the compare. Have you seen the compare? Where you can say password and then username. Sorry, password, and then you have another field which is confirm password. That's another reason to use a view model. Where would you put the confirm password? In the view bag? So you would put the confirm password, and then you can put an attribute which is compare to password, and it will automatically implement client-side and server-side validation to compare the two values, right? The password matches, it doesn't match. There's another attribute which is called remote, which it makes an AJAX call. So, for example, I type in a username, and you know that quickly thing comes up that says, oh, username is taken, right? Choose another one. That's very easy. You can just go to a customer now. Do I have a customer here? I don't. Oh, dear. Oh, I know. I have an item. Item. And you can come here and you can just write remote, right? Pretend it works. And you put the action and the controller name. And what that will do is it will make an AJAX call from the client to the server. You can do some validation and you return a true or a false. And based on that, validation will pass or not. Very cool. So it's the typical, you know, sign up. Oh, that username is taken. Okay, so remote fluent validation is another product that you can download, and it's also got hooks out of the box for MVC3. So you have fluent validation and fluent validation MVC3 as a NuGet package. And what you're doing there is now I have my models. So you see, I have my models, for example, confirm view model, create new view model, items listing view model, etc. And I have another file folder called validators, and it uses a fluent interface. Okay. So it says, Login validator rule for model username should not be empty, and it should be with this message. It's a nice fluent interface. Now, if you don't put a custom message, in fact, you get, if I'm not mistaken, 8 different languages out of the box. So you don't even have to do localization. Right? And then it has support for other things. So, for example, I could say is an email address, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So this, one of the issues with this is now, hey, if I'm going to create view models from one side and the validation from the other side, what I don't want to do every time, remember, to say that this view model is this view model validator. I mean, sorry, this view model validator is for this view model. That also comes out of the box. What it does is it creates a file over here in infrastructure, which is the structure map dependency resolver. No, not that guy. Structure map validator. And what it does is, this is the part that hooks into the validation framework of MVC. Okay? This part is important because what it does is allow you to override the data annotation validation and plug in your own mechanism. This is one of the good extensibility points of MVC 3. Okay? But it also does automated scanning. So you see this guy over here. What I'm doing on this one is saying, find, this is a call that comes with Fluent Validation. Says find validator in assembly containing one of the validators, and for each of them, register it and use a singleton. So here's another cool thing you can do with an IOC container. What? You can control the lifetime of an object. You can say, I want this to be a singleton. I want it to be a not singleton, defined by HTTP scope, defined by session. All these things now you can do over here. Right? Another advantage of an IOC container. So that's a fluent validation. Very nice. Clean, fluent interface for you to set up. And you can extend it and set up kind of like more complex business rules, etc. Any questions? So I'm wondering why half of the room is looking that way and the other half is looking that way, and I just realized there's TV monitors there. So, how many of you have gone to Glen Block's REST? How many of you know what REST is? Those that went should keep their hands up. Okay. So REST stands for Representational State Transfer. And Glenn and I always have a discussion about this because, you know, he's working on WCF, the API for REST, and I'm a big fan of using MVC for REST, right? And I'm sure that internally they have discussions as well. But the benefit that you get with MVC is that it actually is a great framework to create RESTful applications. It is. But on top of that, what you also get is what? You get a UI. So you can create an MVC application as a RESTful service without a UI. And when you want the UI, you just slap it on. Right? You don't need to fire up WCF or anything like that. So how do you do RESTing servers? Now, there's different levels of REST. There's the Leonard Richardson maturity model, which those of you that went are familiar with. But basically, REST is a multiple things. It's a series of constraints. It's about resources. Everything is a resource. The representation of that resource. So, for example, I have a customer. It can be an image of a customer. It can be a customer record. It can be a JSON representation. And it's about state transfer, which is the one thing that a lot of people forget. It's about hypermedia. It's about allowing the server to define the flow of your workflow. It's about, I make an order, and the server says, you made an order. These are the next steps that you can take. You know how a web page works? You go to a web page, and it says, oh, you've made an order. Do you want to click here to go to the next step? That's exactly it. Using that same concept for computers to talk to each other. Okay? I'm simplifying it a little bit, but it's actually very simple. So we can use that also in MVC. We can leverage HTTP methods, we can leverage status codes, and we can leverage content types. I'm going to show you how you do that, and then I'll show you a better way to do that. So this is a verbs routing. Now, this is ugly in a sense because I don't want to do this all the time. I want to use conventions. I don't want to have to put attributes on my routes or put constraints on my routing table. See here that I have my controller with details, delete, update, etc. Notice that I don't have any attributes. I don't have any HTTP post, HTTP get. Why? Because in my routing table, that's where I'm doing all the work. I'm creating all these routes, right? And I'm using a routing constraint to say if this route matches or not. Okay? However, However, I don't want to write all this either. So yes, you can do it, but that's a disadvantage. I'll show you a better way in 7 minutes. Okay? The other thing that you can do is leverage content types. So one of the things that REST can do, you can say, oh, I have a customer, and if you write customer.json, it will bring you back a JSON representation of that customer. And that can either be sent by the URL or what's called content negotiation, which is the accept header sends application/JSON. And then the server says, oh, there's a content header coming in, application/JSON, I'm going to send this back as JSON, right? Here's a very bad hack of showing you, but the code is very simple. Again, this is not how you would do it. But what this does is it's a filter on action executed, checks to see if there's any extensions passed in, and if there is, we'll filter it by that type. So I'm just going to fire this up, and I'm going to go and hit customer 26, and you'll see that it says resource not found. Sorry, it says view not found because I don't have a view. However, if I go to Fiddler and go to the request builder, you see I have customer 26, and I have a header there as application JSON, right? And I hit enter. You see, I get a 200 back, and I can go to the raw, and you can see that I have my JSON coming back. Okay, so now let's look at the actual controller code. Am I doing that encoding in the controller? No, I'm doing it in the filter. So if I go to the customer controller, and here is the get. That's it, you see? There's no, if extension is JSON, do this. There's no filter even on that. It's a global filter registered, and it will automatically detect it. Very easy to do. You do it once, it's done. Okay? So, coping with large sites. This is a quick one. There is a method in MVC which is called render action, which allows the view to call a controller to render some data, right? To render actions of another controller. That's how you cope with large sites. If you want to make Amazon, you don't put all this in your home controller. You divide this up into different controllers. So you have a search controller, you have a shopping cart controller, you have a shop controller, etc. And then you call that out from your web page. So here's a quick sample. So I have a home controller here. And you see all it does is the default home controller. Let's go to the view, right? So we'll go to this guy. And you see that I have, this is actually MVC 1 compiling with 3, and it works. See, I have render action index because render action was actually in the futures lib, in the futures library as a separate download since MVC 1. It's not new in 2 or 3. So I can say render action index search, render action index offers, etc. And when you run this, each of these will call out to their controllers, to their actions, and display the information for that. Okay, that's how you cope with large sites. And if there is no logic in them, if there's no behavior, then you can just do a user control, which is just a partial view. Okay. Now, two last things before we finish is NuGet. Some of the stuff I just showed you, I'm going to show you how you can modify it a little bit to make it even easier. One of them is the automapper. So all the code for this you can get at, I'll give you. You can send me an email, I'll give it to you, or the conference organizers will have it. But here is an auto map. This is a package I made last night, because I'm working actually on a different thing, which will even avoid you having to write a filter, but I haven't got that ready yet. But this is the package I made last night. So it's just a project, and inside that project, I have a C# file, right? And I've put the PP to it, because what that allows you to do is that when NuGet downloads that, it will process it. What will it process? It will replace some things. What is it going to replace? These values that are available to me, properties of the actual project. So I say replace the root namespace with your project, right? That's all it does. And the only thing, now let's look at the package config. That's the package that I'm using inside this project. If we open up the NuGet, where's my NuGet? Yes, thank you. That's the guy. You see that I have a dependency on AutoMapper, and that's it. And I say, grab this guy and put it in the content. Content means deploy it to the project. Where? In a folder called filters. So All I need to do now is create a new project. And go to the package manager. This is the time now it's going to crash. It's like, you got 4 minutes left, and I'm going to crash. Okay? So, in the package manager, and again, it'll blow up on me, and I'll just write something, and it'll just be okay. And I'll write install package. And now I've got this package locally. I haven't raised this to NuGet. Okay, so I write install package. I'll zoom that in a minute. And I'm going to define the source because I have it in my NuGet local. I've got the entire NuGet repository over here. See NuGet? You can go here. I got it all. You want it? I'll give it to you. I got NuGet over here, and I'll say, what's the name of the package I want to install? It's called AutoMapper. Come on. It's local, guys. There's no internet. So don't blame me for this, right? Blame. Yeah, blame Microsoft. So, how's the weather outside? You've not been, no? We're all like hermits here. AutoMap. You see MVC, right? I got AutoMap MVC. I install that. It installed AutoMapper. The dependency is all good. And see what it's done? It has come and it has created a filter for me over here, which is the AutoMap filter. Nicely replaced my MVC application. So now all I have to do is in my home controller, when I want to do a mapping, I just say AutoMap filter. And then I put the two types and done. So I don't have to write that line. That's what you were asking for before. And why don't I do it with a filter? Okay? And the last thing I want to show you is EasyMVC. So what I'm doing here is I'm getting some RESTful stuff and some other things. This was actually a project which I started, which was initially called AutoREST. But since I'm putting in other things, I've renamed it to EasyMVC. Because Easy is the kind of my prefix for my projects. There's EasyHttp, there's EasyCouchDB, there's EasyMVC. And what I'm doing here is I'm using routing conventions. Okay, so remember when I showed you, I said with REST, you can map all these things with your routes or your routes, right? I don't want to do that manually. So what I can do is use routing conventions, and then let me just show you the before routing conventions. So basically what this does is it allows you to define routing conventions. These are the defaults. And it says, I want to map list to root plural. What that means is that if I have a controller that has a method, the controller is called customer, that has a method called list, to access that via the URL, it's going to be customers. Right? If I have a method, an action, that is delete, doesn't have to have any verbs or anything like that on it, no routing, nothing. If I have an action that's called delete, if someone makes a request with a delete, it will go to that action. For you to use this in your actual application, all you have to do, well, MVC application, all you need to do is add one line of code. Next version, you won't have to add that either. That's a joke. So you just add that, and it will automatically scan your assembly, define the routes following the conventions. What this also allows you to do is what I just showed you with the filters for content type negotiation. That's built into this as well, although it does need a little bit of tweaking. So with this, if you follow the conventions, you don't need to do any mapping, put any attributes on your actions, nothing. If you don't want to even use it for a REST, you can just use it and avoid having to put the HTTP POST and HTTP GET discriminator, which you normally do. Okay? That all of this is available on NuGet, and it's also available on my GitHub account, which is github.com/hariri. Okay, that's it. I'm done. Wow. Cool. So, I apologize if I talked too loud or I went too fast. I wanted to get as much as I could in there. That's my contact details. Feel free to contact me. Thanks.